Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. We're back for another episode of The Week in Sports Cars with my friend and co-pilot, Graham Goodwin from DailySportsCar.com, but you're actually plural. You don't just cover one car, which is good. That would be rather boring. Dear Graham, tell us about the Geneva show and what you trailed is maybe happening, but didn't happen, but we're not sure when it's going to happen. Some tire testing that you were just attending. Then we're going to get into Sebring a little bit. Then we're going to dive into listener Q&A for what will be the shortest episode to date, because I have to leave in 1 hour to catch a plane.
Absolutely, Marshall. Let's keep it rolling. Yep, Geneva show, very interesting. Two or three interesting and potentially important cars, but I think the one you're particularly referring to was what eventually emerged as the McLaren Senna GTR, not GTE. But I think a lot of people did expect that to actually emerge at Geneva as a GTE concept for a return of the UK-based brand to the Le Mans 24 Hours for the first time since the late 1990s with the iconic McLaren F1. But the car came out as a GTR, in other words, not aiming at the moment for a race program. And in fact, comments from senior management at the show indicate there is no race program planned for that car. Now, whether or not that's no race program for the Senna, whether or not that's no race program for the GTR remains to be seen. But I believe what's going on here is that this is a sign of some robustious internal debate at Woking between a side of the business that would like to see more going on with the GT road car based race effort. And on the other side, I think headed probably by, our friend and colleague, Zach Brown, as the head of McLaren Technology Group, that would like to see a commitment from McLaren potentially to what comes next in the world of LMP1, whether or not that's GT prototype with a stylized prototype looking a little bit more like a road car, or whether or not it's something more particularly race car looking. But I think that is what's going on. I think there is definitely intent for the brand to come back to endurance racing at that highest level. But there's now an awful lot of discussion, both within McLaren and indeed within the rulemakers, to determine what will be available to them. But there's no doubt at all, a lot of people were expecting it. Few people were surprised. A few more people were disappointed. And we don't yet have a position where we can say with certainty that above GT3 customer racing that McLaren are going to be back.
Tell me a little bit, my man, about yet again more busy travel. You've been a man on many planes, yet to very few races this year.
Oh, good grief, yes. And there's a lot of testing going on. We've already seen testing, of course, in North America. There's all sorts of testing being going on across Europe. The guys have been looking for the good weather. It's been pretty difficult to find in Western and Southern Europe in recent days and weeks. But down with Dunlop Tires in Motorland Aragon, some 3 hours out of Barcelona. It takes something under 2 hours to fly to Barcelona from London. It takes longer than that to drive to the circuit. Very remote. Do have MotoGP out there. But a five-day test for Dunlop customers, LMP2, GTE, and indeed GT3 cars will be taking part in the VLN Championship around the Nordschleife at the Nürburgring. But I think in our world, MP, it's the GTE cars and the LMP cars that pique the interest. And I guess the first thing to say is, five-day test, we were allowed absolutely complete access for about a day and a half of that, thanks to the guys at Dunlop, with a number of my journalistic colleagues actually shadowing some of the tire engineers. And you'll be, I'm sure, reading that in a number of publications in the weeks and months to come. But interesting from me, at least one of the team attending just for a day or two and then off again. And I suspect we are going to see probably tire competition in some depth in the FIWEC and LMP2. I'm expecting two or three LMP2s on Michelins and the remainder of the field on Dunlops. Good to see the first of the privateer 911 RSRs running.
Absolutely.
Boy, oh boy. I played a little game actually earlier today with my colleague, Stephen Kilby. Played him a little bit of video of some of the GT cars passing the pit lane and asked him with his eyes closed to guess which one was the GT car. It wasn't difficult. The Mon with 10 of those cars, MP, is going to be absolutely astounding. They just sound like all the bad things in the world have been nailed into the boot.
I think that was the title of an adult movie. Good Lord. I mean, sanitize it a little bit here, Goodwin. Come on, man.
Well you, I'll tell you something. Here's another little aside. Just by reading the papers this morning, there is a sports car racing link with an adult movie this week.
Really?
At least an adult movie star. Am I correct that the young lady that is attempting to take legal action against your good president... at the moment, is represented by one Michael Avenatti?
I don't honestly know.
I believe that. And Michael, of course, ex-IMSA racer. I think it's the same Michael Avenatti. And that's one that's going to be coming up the other end. Back to tyre testing. Sorry, diverted myself. We need to keep this to an hour, don't we?
And quit talking about ends so much, you're pervert. Come on.
So, what we've got with Dunlop this year, and it's interesting because that challenge is now coming again from Michelin in the LMP2 class on the global front, is they are allowed three compounds of, by regulation, three compounds of slick tyre, one intermediate, one wet tyre. And it's fair to say that in the last couple of years, Dunlop wets have been somewhat tricky, and at least one of their slick compounds was needed to be in what was a very narrow operating window of temperature to make the thing work. All five are new this year. So all five were being tested, and happily for the teams, we did have a little bit of wet weather in the mountains in Aragon. And we're hearing some pretty good things as well about performance of those tyres and performance of the P2 cars. Remember, these cars were very new this time last year. And all the teams telling me that they expect the cars to be somewhere between 5 and 8 tenths quicker a lap on a regular track this year.
Good Lord. It would be awesome really to see quick. How they go on irregular tracks as well. We had go ahead, mate. Sorry.
So one final significant story that came out of there. There's been a bit of two or three controversies that came out. We know from the ACO's announcement of the FIWC and the LMS full season entries, one of which was the seeming green light being given to a three-man driver crew in the European Le Mans Series, and that for that matter at the Le Mans 24 Hours, which is one platinum-ranked driver, Jean-Éric Vergne, two gold-ranked drivers. That would be Roman Roussanov and Mathieu Vassevière in the 26 TDS Racing G-Drive car. That has now been turned around. It was always there with a bit of a proviso next to it, but that's now been turned around. And indeed, we saw a couple of different drivers driving for that team. I don't think, going to see Jean-Éric Vergne. We're definitely not going to see Mathieu Vassevière in that car. And a couple of quick young men being tested alongside Roman Roussanov. So another of the controversies that kind of fell out of those February announcements appears to be now kind of relegated to the annals of history.
We're moving into two busy weekends in North America now, Graham. Thankfully, you'll be here for one of them. I'm headed off here momentarily to St. Petersburg in Florida for the Pirelli World Challenge season opener on the streets there. And then we roll directly into the Mobile One 12 Hours of Sebring. We've had entry lists for both series released in the recent days. Interesting to see what we expected in World Challenge, where the GT class, the GT Pro, there isn't a technical GT Pro, but there is a GTA, which is GTAM. Interesting to see that the GTA class for the Pro-Am GT3 entries, definitely more packed, more, I would almost say more interesting than the GT class itself, just because the numbers are down, as we discussed last week. Some of the marquee teams that we discussed are not included. Doesn't mean the racing won't be great. I mean, come on, when you have any amount of pro drivers in GT3 cars on a street course like St. Petersburg, there will be fireworks, and there will also be many, many visits to the support trailers to get new fenders and suspension and wings and dive planes. I am looking forward to a really fun weekend for World Challenge to open their year. Then we also move on to right after that, and we're gonna do our first live, well, live meaning you and I are together in the room, recording of the weekend sports cars at Sebring. But that entry list came out as well, Graham, and 43 cars. Yeah, a still to me a very impressive 16 prototype car count atop the series. We look at the same number of 9 for the GTLM cars, and a slight dip. Numbers down just a little bit. We have lost 4 cars from the 24 Hours of Daytona. Actually, the class winning GRT Grasser program was definitely not listed on the entries, which we'd love to see. A little bit strange when they weren't, but who knows? Maybe they'll surprise us with an awesome turn up. But we do have CJ Wilson Racing making their debut, so we brought back one of the 4 cars in terms of losses, and they've also listed Kuno Whitmer as their choice of third driver. So a fair amount of interesting stuff there that we will delve into in full depth next week when we are together in Sebring, Graham. We also expect there could be one or two changes on the entry list among drivers, some who are listed or some who were, let's say, written in on the entry when they were due, but might not be there for a variety of circumstances. So we should know more next week and be able to flesh that out a little bit. Let's do something crazy and earlier than we have ever done in our lovely little new sporty car show here. Oh, by the way, as we read, I think last week, you and I proudly claim to have the newest and youngest
Ah,
sports
it's
car
brilliant.
podcast in the world, right? I mean, we can't quite measure up to the longest tenured one, which is, I believe, 2 years old, or is it maybe two and a half, 3 years old? So,
I would think that that goes down to the history back to 2005, as I recall, for the still hugely popular, correctly so, Midweek Motorsport. You and I, regular visitors to that. I think we're a proud addition to the family. People are kind of coochie cooing under the chin of
Oh.
Wigan sports cars. Oh, aren't they lovely? Well, we're not that lovely,
No.
but I should say, by the way, thank you to everybody for some very kind comments through social media, the odd email as well, to be listening in to our ramblings. I'm thoroughly enjoying it so far, but it's going, I think, pretty well.
Our friend Shay Adam said she's listened to 3.5 episodes so far. So that, good Lord, that must feel like homework. That's far too long. But we're fixing that today. We are definitely going short. But it, as Juan Montoya likes to say, it is what it is. And as for us here, we're very good at revisionist history and claiming things that we don't rightfully own. But that's why everybody loves us. Who nobody loves a country more than America. All right, well, as we tend to do here, we have asked for questions. We've received, oh good Lord, what are we up to? Almost 30 questions,
Wow.
the vast majority of them being awesome. We also ask you to like the ones that you want us to answer first, or we've also frankly just asked for some discussion topics you'd like to hear the two of us to get through. And but I also did mention when sending out the request for questions that we had an hour. So despite the 30 or so that have come in, we've got about 40-ish minutes to do this, to get this done. So let's see. Well, first of all, we've got the comment here from our friend Jeff Brown, race engineer, but well, leave us alone, Jeff. We've got sports car fans to interact with at the moment here. All right, let's kick this off here. with a question from Michael Goodyear, and I could have just mangled your last name, but that's one of the charms of our little show. He says he was intrigued to hear that Pietro Fittipaldi is making his debut in a P1 car this year as a substitute for Renger van de Zande at Spa and Fuji. He said the kid seems like he's on the way up and fast, a rising star. He says, with Graham having been on hand to see him drive during the WC rookie test last year and in a different setting, he's curious if it's still relevant to his skills as a driver. Do you think this is a kid whose skills can just transfer over into a P1 car, P2, G, whatever? Do you think this kid's an all-rounder?
I think so. Well, he won the final World Series, the old Renault 3.5 V8 championship final World Series, which was effectively an official feeder series to the WC. So, number one, it's good to see that actually, even in its final year, that worked a little. Had a long chat with Elton Julian about this one. He's very proud to offer Pietro that opportunity. Did pretty well in the rookie test. That was part of his prize of winning World Series, and I hope so. We're seeing a whole range of young drivers coming into all sorts of sports cars, principally LMP2. But yes, Pietro won the first to hit the LMP1 side of things, and a number into GTs as well, where the transition, I think, is more difficult. What we tend to hear about modern sports prototypes, LMP2 and upwards, is that the guys who've done single-seaters up to quite a decent level find the reference points really pretty easy. I mean, an old style LMP2 car back in the Nissan V8 days, for instance, a lot of the guys who come in from, say, Formula 3, recognize the kind of handling characteristics, had to get used to the extra weights and the slight extra bulk of the car. But the main thing they tend to find difficult is the fact that they've actually got a roof over their heads. That tends to be the one that messes with their head a little bit in the early days. So hopefully Pietro can actually get a little bit of testing. There's not going to be a huge amount of time to do that because Dragon Speed, Julian's team, with the BR1 Dallara built chassis and the Gibson engine, which, by the way, heard for the first time, has been at least dyno testing for some months, that engine. So that bodes well for the speed of that car. That's hopefully he's going to get some seat time, and I expect him to be quick. Yes, I do. I expect him to be quick. It's going to be interesting to see how he adapts to the other part of the equation, which is sharing a car.
Oh, well, considering that he is spending the 2018 season in the Verizon IndyCar Series sharing a car with Zachary Clayman DeMello, it seems like the kid is truly training the right way to do that. Granted, open wheel series, so they're not physically jumping in and out during the same event. But having watched the kid in a couple of tests now, road course stuff, obviously, that is his background. The part that's impressed me is how quickly he has gone on ovals. Granted, he does have some NASCAR oval stuff in his background, but to climb into an IndyCar and be right up there up top among the rookies and even putting some of the veterans behind him in preseason testing, I think this does speak to the fact that Pietro, this kid's playing with something rather special. Don't know
Oh,
if we're
yeah.
talking world champion grade special. He'll let us know. I mean, he's still a young kid, but his family has done something with him that I think is brilliant to cover this off quickly, Graham. And it's very similar to what Penske, Team Penske president Tim Cindric has done with his son Austin. Rather than pushing Austin into whichever direction or letting Austin just go in the one direction that appeals to him most, Tim was 100% committed to saying, no, I'll let you do a season of this. We'll do World Challenge. Great. But then we're going to move you over and do some open wheel and then some NASCAR trucks and then some GT racing and then some prototype racing. And so while this kid is, still going to school, he has driven so many cars, not just once, but multiple times, full season, partial season, whatever it is, that his point of reference is universal. And so now Austin climbs into just about anything. And oval, road course, roof over his head, no roof, doesn't matter. The kid's a rocket. And we can absolutely say that the approach taken with Pietro has not only been the same, but seems to be paying off to the same amount, maybe even more. Interesting. I love it, and I'm hoping that we see more of this. More of this. Hey, maybe you were a young open wheel talent, but let's not wait until you're 32 and all the opportunities have dried up before you go and try something else. Get in early and do it. And I think that might actually, Graham, become the new model. So.
I hope so, because it is an old-fashioned sort of model, isn't it? And the one thing that I have to say is that one of those references that I'm not sure how comfortable I am with it is this is one of the very first guys at the real top of his game in my time of reporting that I'm actually reporting on the grandson of a significant race driver. You've had a bit of that, though, I think, but I've not had quite so much. A little bit of Marco Andretti back in the days when he was having a crack at a bit of LMP1. He did that with Rebellion Racing for a couple of races. But Pietro Fittipaldi, yet another grandson of a very famous grandfather, having a crack in an LMP1 car.
Absolutely. And here you are talking about crack and back ends again. You're really fixated to there, Goodwin. I'm telling you. All right, Mateus Longo says, with the beautiful car now launched, can Rebellion, with so little testing, despite the star-studded driver lineup, be a real contender against Toyota in the FIA WEC Super Season? What do you think, Graham?
I think Toyota thinks that they're getting a little bit worried. There are some moves, by the way. There is a piece of paper doing the rounds at the moment for discussion, which suggests that there might be a further tweak to the regulations, not decided yet, that suggests that perhaps there might be a bit of a longer fueling stop for the non-hybrids than the hybrid cars. Now, I wonder where that might have come from. Let's wait and see. So I'm waiting for a call to our good friends at the ACO to have a discussion about that. But that, I think, would be a real shame. I think the testing times that we talked about on the last week's show, MP, might just have got them thinking. This is not going to be a walkover, okay? If you get, without a shadow of a doubt, if you get a perfect day for a Toyota TS050 in the FIWEC at 6 hours or for 24 hours, it's going to be a really tough ask for the non-hybrid cars. If there's any problem whatsoever, though, that keeps those cars in the pit lane or even, well, God forbid, into the garage, then they are stand potentially ready to get the kind of headlines they don't want in the 2018-19 super season. And in part, another part of that kind of debate, which has been around the changes that WEC plan to make for the pit stops, where you'll be able to fit tyres at the same time you fuel, something I know is pretty familiar to IMSA sports car championship watchers, something we've not had in the WEC. That is all to do with actually increasing the show. I've now had that conversation with the ACO to ask what was the thought behind it. It is all about the way that those pit stops actually appear to a watching audience. They're looking to up the show. I hope they're not tempted to take away a little from the potential for a shock result, because boy, do we love a shock result.
We'd love shock results. Well, let me rephrase. We minus Toyota love shock results. I don't know if Toyota could take another shock result to the heart, or we might have to indeed perform a shock to the heart. That I mean that. I believe, Graham, that is what most fans, and I would say media, I would say just about everybody is hoping that Toyota has. Not occasional competition, but someone to, as you mentioned, worry about at every round. Something that can, make sure if you're going to turn up and you are indeed a fan of prototypes and you do like watching the cars that are setting the fastest lap times, that it isn't just a foregone conclusion as to who's going to come
Completely
out
right.
on top. And, there's also a little bit of nature involved here. We have the Toyotas, which instead of rolling out a brand new car, they are smartly using their money in an intelligent fashion and have developed, continued to evolve their package. And then you have, in many instances, brand new non-hybrid competitors with cars that are new, chassis that are new, engines that are new, engines that might be evolutions from other engines, but there are still question marks. We can't say in most cases that the LMP1 non-hybrid field is going to be packed front to end with cars that are just known, proven quantities, super reliable. It's just truly go out and battle hardcore for 6 hours, 24, whatever the race happens to be. So that could be another way where the Toyotas, despite regulations, despite monkeying with refueling times, speeds, anything to create more parity, we could also see a situation where because the Toyota does have more miles and is a more proven vehicle, could end up being the runaway winner more often than not because the other cars are still new and still learning. So that isn't something you can necessarily build into the rules to try and create drama.
No, I tend to agree with you. I look forward as someone who just loves the competition. What we need is a car that's reliable up against the Toyotas. They're going to be faster than the LMP2s if everything goes well, and you can only hope that comes and comes quickly. Some of the cars are a little late, but they're going to be quicker than the LMP2s. They'll have more fuel, they'll have more power, they'll have less weight, they'll have better aero. I keep coming back to what happened at the Le Mans 24 Hours last year. What they have to do is to have full reliability and stay ahead and well ahead of the LMP2 cars. If they can do that, and the circumstances of Toyota's afternoon or overnight come back to them, then we can dream.
We can dream. I love it. Now we're getting back to something inspirational, Graham. Okay, it's Susan Bowley asks, or Bowley. Hi, guys. So the possible move to road car styling for prototypes sounds great for manufacturers, but where would it leave small constructors like Ginetta?
Very simple. If I guess there's two ways. Actually, another thing that goes back to the Geneva show, given an opportunity here to see what one potential route might be like. Because one of the other cars that had the wraps taken off was the AMR Pro version of the Aston Martin Valkyrie. This is the Adrian Newey design car, an astonishing looking thing. Now that is an absolute uber hypercar, fully focused for track use. That
Uber.
makes
That is actually a new class. I'm writing this one down as we speak. The new Uber hyper
Uber
class.
hypercar. So
Yeah,
I mean,
hypercar, and they have a natural sponsor for that series as well.
there you go. And you can give them reviews after they're finished.
Give them a lift. Yes.
Absolutely. So that is, make no mistake, that Dr. Andy Palmer, who is the head of Aston Martin, that's the route that he would like the ACO to go for in terms of new LMP1. It would seem to me that the favoured option is something different. It's something based on a chassis, monocoque, if you like, that we know from current prototype racing or something remarkably like it, but with styling cues that make it look more like the brand, a little more close to a race car, but not something that is based on a road car, however extreme. And yes, there's kind of shades of grey between, but that is the current debate. That, and of course, the other part of it that we know, which is where do you get the technology that the ACO are looking for into that equation? So it all comes down to a choice in terms of the philosophy about the cars, a choice in terms of the technology in the cars, and a choice in terms of, where do the various manufacturers go? But coming back to the question, where does that leave us? Well, I'd like to think there's going to be active encouragement for anybody coming into that new marketplace to think about whether or not there is an opportunity, maybe in year two, for some of these cars to find themselves into privateer hands. That has to be a good thing in terms of the cost effectiveness of the program, simply because you get to sell the cars and you get to sell the parts for those cars. We are looking at the potential for some of that tech to be reeled in. For me, and it's a position I've made previously, the only concern I have about something that is road car based is we talk about speed, we talk about efficiency. There's also the other parts of the equation, the cocktail of endurance racing, which is serviceability. And the worry I have is the cost if you get into something that is essentially road car based. How quickly can you turn that around in extremis if there's an issue during a race? And the last time we saw this in competition was back in 2012 when Toyota made their debut at the end of that year from Le Mans onwards, where that was not the designated race car, that was the development car. That was not a car that initially, in a season that should have seen Peugeot go up against Audi. That original TSO 20 was not, or 30 rather, was not originally the car that was meant to race. And that meant that when they did have a problem, and the one that I think most people remember was when a light panel failed in Bahrain, it took them way too long. They had to deconstruct the entire side of the car to get that fixed because it wasn't designed as a race car. I want to see that avoided. You don't, whatever else you want to see, you don't want to see a race car in the garage for a pretty routine repair because it takes too long. And that, I think, has to be addressed as well.
If you look at trends, we can certainly say the prototype, what we know of as the sports racing prototype today, that was truly a road car development. That, granted, for those that know the various stories and histories under this kind of road car prototype homologation thing, some of the most beautiful Ferraris and Porsches and long tail thises and thats, you know, those were wild evolutions, extreme versions of the road cars that manufacturers produce that they trotted out to race, and we've fallen in love with them. We all dream of owning a Porsche 906, 917, Ferrari 512, this, you know, and whatnot.
Long tail McLaren F1. I mean, I think one of the hands down most beautiful things. It is one of the cars of my dreams, I have to tell you. And you know, if we can go down that road, if that can be made sustainable, I'd be there front of the queue to shake the hand of the man who came up with those regulations. I hope they can do it, and I hope we can do it with enough cars on the grid, sustainably on the grid. And for me, the other part of the equation, variety. Variety for me has always been the key to sports car racing that I can get behind and love.
And that's where I don't want to see an LMP1 hybrid type class ever disappear. I don't want to see what we have here in North America, the more manufacturer themed, the budget themed manufactured LMP2s, the Daytona Prototype Internationals. But the fact that we do have cars that are locked down. Steve Smith, his question actually fits perfectly with the one that we just went through. And he's talking about, you know, racing in general throughout its history has always been about progress, building bigger, better, stronger, faster. Many evolutionary cycles of innovation, increasing gains of performance. However, in this modern age of racing, we seem to come to a plateau instead of progressing further. Today's cars are actually limited in their performance capabilities for the sake of competition, which feeds into what I was about to mention about our DPI class. We seem to have more existential conversations each week than maybe some would expect, than just technical nuts and bolts questions. But you have to wonder, Graham, knowing that prototypes were truly road car based, at least you could see the DNA. They were constructed originally, you know, by road car people, wild bodywork, wild engines and whatnot, but these were extensions of road car products that turned into purebred prototypes, something made specifically by the competition department or heck, even in someone's garage at home. And we loved them, and I still love them. And we've had amazing years, we've discussed before, Group C, IMSA GTP, blah, blah, blah. But we've gotten to a point where if you are racing a prototype in the world, there, anywhere in the world, there's only one place where you can have ideas of your own, implement them, and participate on a professional level. That's LMP1 Hybrid. The class has crumbled. There's only one manufacturer left doing that. And everywhere else, LMP2, LMP3, our DPI class here, you name it. It is
There's
all
elements of
locked
spec.
down. It's all homologated. True fun and ideas have been written out, as Steve Smith mentions here. Steve, of course, being the father of David Smith, who we recently discussed went through that unfortunate fire and lost his Continental Tire hat, which was replaced by Jordan Taylor. So to Steve, and also to the question about prototypes moving back more in that manufacturer direction, if the answer is a future prototype model where you can evolve and you can think and innovate and play, and you are allowed to try things and fail, because that's another big thing, Graham, that's been more or less written out. Folks have been protected themselves from trying ambitious ideas in anywhere but that top LMP1 hybrid class. I'd be all for it. As long as, again, we don't burn this whole thing down because it costs so much to participate. So whether it's road-inspired Valkyries or whatever else, as long as it has an element of openness to it, I'm in.
Well, let me give you a bit of hope here, Steve, in terms of the way that direction that people are actually thinking. We have got a debate. We've got the McLaren side on one side of the debate. We've got Aston Martin on the other side of the debate. We've seen concept cars from Toyota recently, not just the GTE concept car that we saw this time at Geneva, but the hybrid powered, the TSO50 tech powered road car based idea at the Toyota Auto Salon. Then there's the other part of it. There's a piece I wrote just last week on Daily Sports Car about the potential programs we might see coming forward in GTE. And in that, I covered the potential for GT3 and GTE versions of the Glickenhaus. And it's Glickenhaus, the SCG004, and Jim Glickenhaus and his little équipe promising to bring something with reasonable numbers of road cars. Of the, another hyper sports car, not an Uber hyper this time, but just a hyper sports car,
Okay, fair enough.
to the road. Jim was very quick to respond to that piece and make it very clear. I think he feels he'd been perhaps misquoted by another journalist whose piece I was quoting, by saying that no, he's interested in LMP1 and a version of that car. Now, whether or not that can happen, but it speaks, doesn't it, exactly to what you were just saying, MP, about this is a guy with a more boutique brand, if you like, who is a little bit left field, but he's attracted by that. I'd like to add as well, I know my friends at the ACO had their fingers burned by effectively counting out their own LMP1 privateer class with the dominance of the hybrid cars. I don't think they're going to allow that to happen again. Whether or not they get one, two, three, four new manufacturers interested, I think they will remember that journey, that experience. And I think whatever we see, whether or not it's something written in that they tried to get to the stage where the budgets we're talking about are more accessible for a potential privateer entry, or whether or not there's some kind of backdoor, I don't expect to see a rule book appearing in the near future that makes it impossible for a privateer to compete in that class.
I would love to see that. And Jim's a nut, but he's a good nut.
Oh yeah, he's everybody's type of favorite nut, and I say that with absolute love and respect. I've spent some fantastic time talking to Jim on and off the record about both his historic cars, and he's got some beautiful historic cars, most, if not all of which, he has actually drives on the road, and also the fabulous bespoke cars that he's built for himself and latterly for customers. It was one of those, by the way, Derek, and the car bound for the Nürburgring. It looks stunning in all white livery. HPD engine in the back of the race car, BMW engine, I think, in the back of the road cars, the SCG003. He's exactly the kind of guy I would love to see involved in LMP1.
All right, Graham Goodwin, we are genuinely and truly rounding towards a surprise and fast finish here for the sixth edition of the Week in Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. Got to do a little bit of NASCAR voice there. My apologies. Doug Bonham. Doug, really like this question. And it also feels today, Graham, like I'm just interviewing you, which is fine, actually. Let the reporter interview the reporter. That format works for me this week. Doug asks, how about Toyota? There's a new super concept at Geneva, and it looks like it could be a GT racer right now. He said, do you see Toyota adding a factory and private supporting GTE effort alongside its P1 team? Or GT3 maybe, et cetera, et cetera. And I would maybe add to that thoughts about whether Toyota could potentially replace its P1 hybrid program at some point in the nearish future after the Super Season, Graham, to get in on the fairly awesome GTE Pro game.
It's a really intriguing question and a really intriguing prospect. Just to tell those who haven't seen it, this is a Toyota Supra. It's a shared platform with BMW. The Supra name makes its comeback to road car, but they chose not to present the road car, but to present a race car concept designed effectively to GTE standards. Not the first time that Toyota have done this in the recent past, by the way. They did the same with a Lexus LFA. Car that TMG in Cologne designed to full GTE spec. That car then disappeared for quite some time, and it reappeared, slightly amended, and did battle with the factory team. And that is the kind of factory in terms of the engineers and their management team actually having a day out for the Nürburgring 24 Hours. That car reappeared and raced at the Nürburgring 24 Hours. What do I know about the car? More than I'm prepared to say publicly. What do I expect to happen with the car? I genuinely don't know. I think there are a couple of things that may happen. There is a bit of a problem for Toyota in 2019, 2020. It's clear to me they are committing to whatever emerges with the new regulations, but that will be 2020, 2021. That means they've either got to stick with what they've got next year. Next season, rather, not next year, in 2019, 2020, or they've got to come up with a plan B to maintain a presence. Could it be this? I sort of like to think they would, because what that then does, it gets quite close, MP, to what you were just talking about, and what one of the listeners was talking about, which is you could run a single year GTE program, and that could then become your customer offering. Now, wouldn't that be something?
Smart. I love it when you tell us things you or tr want to tell us things that you can't, but it's okay. Today on the Interviewing the Interviewer show, we're having fun with Graham Goodwin, boys and girls. All right, mate, let's sweep through a few more here, and then we are going to ship this out for listening. Huh. All right. Although this didn't get any likes, I'm going to give it a like and use it. Gavin Wing Jr. asks, if Ford ends their GT program without a championship of any kind, would you consider the program a failure or a success?
Would I consider it a
All
success?
right, you've got three calls coming in, so
I'm
someone
afraid, yeah,
must have heard that.
that's now that's that would be Mrs. DSC editor not realizing I'm recording a podcast, but it's okay, it's all fine. So what? It's won Le Mans. That is number one, two, and three on the agenda. It's won Daytona. That covers off four, five, and six. Whatever happens, that car has won two of, if not the two, major endurance races within its capabilities. So I think the answer is that yes, it's been a success. It's done what it was designed to do. Has it exercised the entire dominance that it could have done over its GTE brethren? No, it hasn't. But in the annals of sports car racing history, the reality is, in we're going to get to that first mention of it, Marshall, in BOP terms, it's never going to be allowed to dominate. It would never be allowed to get to the stage of utter and complete dominance.
Bob Canestraro asks, what is the best way to follow Sebring in real time? We'll probably get into this a little bit more in depth next week, but he asks, are there certain Twitter accounts or blogs, I love that term, blogs, that are updated often? And that's an interesting question. I mean, we can point you to some of the familiar ones. You wouldn't be surprised if I pointed you towards racer.com, which is my what I do the majority of my days, and my client dailysportscar.com with
I've heard
Graham.
they're both quite good.
Yeah,
there's a
they're
couple of
okay.
guys couple of guys who
questionable
are going to.
hiring practices, but so I could point you to the places where you would go, well, of course he's going to say that. But I mean, look, the reality is, Bob, IMSA.com does a very excellent job in presenting timing and scoring information, depending on where you are in the world. If you're in North America, it's geo-blocked, but if you're outside of actually, I shouldn't say North America, the United States, I believe. You can watch the entire race live on IMSA.com through their TV feed there. They have onboard cameras you can watch at any point in time, no matter where you are in the world. In terms of the live race blog, that's an interesting thing because I know that is something that some outlets prefer. Some outlets even try to live tweet. That has been crazy. Not just Sebring, but Daytona and Le Mans. You go, oh my God! You probably would have to throw your phone away at the end of the race because you have s just destroyed the virtual keypad from, typing a trillion letters into it. What are your thoughts, Graham, for Bob on, if you wanted to stay connected, maybe more through the interwebs or something along those lines instead of sitting in front of a TV? What's the best way to do that? Say in audio form. I wonder,
Well,
is there a service?
is there a service? Maybe would it be great if you could get people that know their stuff that were going to cover the entire race, including, by the way, all of the support races and qualifying and free practice, but in one place where, and it's IMSA Radio, isn't it? I have to say, John Huff and his merry band, it's stunning. It's world class. I'm sorry that. My good friends in the United States do have that geo blocked with the video that goes with it. That's not to take away from our TV colleagues who do
Yes,
a
you're
fantastic
just
job.
saying mean and horrible things, but go ahead. Go
But
ahead.
we do get the privilege of watching and listening online without interruption, and it is a glorious, glorious thing. It is a world-class product. There's no doubt about that. And the fact that it covers now the entire race meeting, it's exhausting for John, Eve, Shay Adam, Jeremy Shaw, and the guys, but boy, is it entertaining! And it's a wonderful thing. It's a great example of how to use streaming technology. But if you are unable to actually watch the pictures that go with it, you've got the choice, obviously, with whatever TV service you can access for this. But you can always listen as well, not just the 12 hours. And this, I think, is where it definitely does hold a massive advantage over on the TV services, but also to the support races and the other on-track sessions. That's absolutely, if I were not there, what I'd be doing in my office or in my home, it'd be there on the background throughout the entire weekend.
All right, Graham Goodwin, we have just a couple minutes left, so we're actually going shorter than an hour because I need to edit this in about 10 minutes and post it and then run out the door. So that should make for some comical visuals for my neighbors.
If that's your trade in the background, mate, you've missed it.
Well, I might be able to stop it. All right, here's a question, and I want to delve into this in much faster, much, I guess, more in-depth layers in the future. But let's close on this. We'll crack this open and we'll come back to it next week. Luke Smolich says, as I asked on Twitter the other day, should IMSA consider vacating Level 5's race results following Scott Tucker's fraud convictions? And the general thought of what if either a champion, team owner, champion driver, team owner, etc., commit some sort of fairly heinous acts? Should their sporting achievements, while using the money from the ill-gotten money in order to achieve those things, should their racing record be essentially written out of history due to the rather nebulous manner that allowed them to participate?
No, I think is the short answer. I think the answer here is, do I like the way he earned his living? No, I don't. Do I think that the team around him, including his co-drivers, and for that matter, Scott himself, earned those results with what they had at their disposal? Yes. would that have happened without ill-gotten gains? Well, for an awfully long time, let's not forget, they weren't ill-gotten gains. There was actually a lot at the time when not a lot of illegal was going on. And then you get into the sub-categories of, do I particularly approve of the way he earns his living? I think the easiest way to do this is no, is leave it. It's on the record what Scott did and where he now is and where he's going to be for some considerable time. And that is as well known as many historical results are and were MP with other notorious exponents of the motorsport arts.
My wife just walked into the office and gave me the unofficial, "What in the world are you doing? We need to leave now." Look, so Graham Goodwin, it is time for us to bid farewell to one another. Fortunately, unfortunately, the next time we will see one another is in person, hopefully having a lovely cup of tea in Sebring, where we're going to give the 12 hours a proper preview and take a much longer dive into questions, many of those that we didn't get to this week and more that we will ask for next week. In the meantime, please check out the good work of Graham and the Daily Sports Car team at dailysportscar.com. I am Marshall Pruitt. This is The Week in Sports Cars, presented by Cooper Tires.